The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There are opportunities which, in the next few years, I think will present themselves as once in a generation, perhaps even once in a thousand year type opportunities. And I think you will be the kind of person that is there to take advantage of them. To me, the route to that end is investing in that strange little asset class that I would call curiosity.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. As promised, the continuation of our listeners' questions answered, Dave. We did two programs, but we got such a response when we asked for the questions. We really needed this third program.
Well, again, I'm looking at a stack that's almost overwhelming. We'll dive right into the questions and see if we can't get them all answered by the end of today's session.
Yeah, okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and start with a question that we heard in the first two programs, but I think it's worth discussing again. This was from Jenny. And again, it's the markets are manipulated. Do you see the end to the manipulation on gold?
Yeah, she says, you know, GATA has shown that precious metals prices are suppressed through regular manipulation. Their proof is fully developed in the following three articles found on GATA.org's website under the left-hand sidebar known as the basics, or called the basics. The question is, do you see any end to this manipulation, or will gold always be suppressed by the world's central banks working through compliant governments? And I think you will ultimately see market muscle overwhelm at some point. So the market trumping central bank activity, that I think is certainly a possibility and a future reality. I don't think we're going to see an end to the manipulation as long as there is a context that enables very little pressure to be put on the gold price for a very large impact. And what I mean by that is this. The backdrop is confidence in the Fed. Confidence in the Fed. As long as the general perception is that the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, other world central banks are able to float the world higher and move asset prices infinitely higher without also running significant rates of inflation, then the investment community is going to ask themselves the question, why own gold? That skepticism in and of itself is the context for a manipulator to come in and say, that's right, you shouldn't, you don't need it. And what it means is that there's an inherent vulnerability in the gold price.
Right.
Because again, you've got skepticism from the investment community that it equals sort of a weak-natured spirit, if you will, in the investment environment. And it means that anyone who wants to press the market any which way they want, it's much easier to do so.
Well, and Dave, you know, I mean, this does remind me of the end of the movie, The Sting. The Sting was Robert Redford, Paul Newman. It was all about a con game. It was very, very convincing, but everything changed very dramatic when that con broke at the end. And the con game with the Federal Reserve is that they can just continue to print money, leave interest rates very, very low, even with this quarter point rise that we've seen. And until that confidence breaks, it'll continue. But boy, when it breaks, everything happens very quick.
And I'll tell you what, I think that the real significance of the 25 basis point move and the suggestion that they can raise rates another 100 points in 2016, I think this is the point where people begin to reevaluate the commitments they've made financially and ask the question, will we see our asset prices continue to float higher on a sea of easy money and easy credit from the world's central banks? Because if the Fed is not going to do this, then our thesis, our growth thesis, is called into question. This means, in my world, that 2016 to 2017 end up being a very compelling time to own gold. And I think you will see a significant rise in the price. And again, this has to do with confidence in the Fed. So you will see a continued expression of manipulation, and it's in an easy environment to do it because there's really nothing fighting. There's no competing volume on the other side of that transaction. If you want to press the price lower, where's the competing volume to press the price higher? The investment community will rally around gold as and when they see the reasons for thinking that all other asset prices are going to be pushed higher by Fed monetary policy. When that dissipates, then Katie, bar the door. Gold's going higher.
This next question's from David, and it's just logistical. He says, how do you transport coins across the state without fear of confiscation from police or the Fed? You know, we've typically used U.S. Postal Service now, Dave, for 42 years, 43 years. It seems to work.
Yeah, I would boil it down to this. We live in an age where you have the incentivization of looting. Sheriff's departments and police departments here in the United States are incentivized to confiscate your assets and keep them if they can, and try to create a story, create a justification for having done so. So I would suggest anytime you're transporting large quantities of precious metals, U.S. Postal Service, registered and insured,
right,
or pay a Brinks or a Loomis or what have you to transport large quantities and high values of metals from point A to point B.
Usually we find about $500,000 to $1 million worth at a time. That's the only time it really makes sense for, say, a Brinks truck, right? Otherwise, U.S. Postal Service is fine.
That's right. I would rather spend a few $100 to ship assets from the East Coast to the West Coast. As crazy as it seems to not be able to carry that on your person, we live in a very corrupted age, and we live in an age where the presumption amongst law enforcement officials is that if you have $10,000 in cash or $20,000 in metals, or God forbid, $500,000 in metals, there must be something nefarious going on. And it's up to you to prove that you're not a criminal. And I know that's not the rule of law. That's not the way our laws are written. But guess what? They are incentivized because their departments get to keep the proceeds or some percentage of the proceeds. So I think at this point we have a corruption of the rule of law, and you need to be minding your P's and Q's. USPS or ship it secured. You can't just walk across state lines anymore.
So those rules don't apply just in Paraguay anymore. I'm sorry. Did I bring something up that stings? All right. So next question. Steve asks, actually a three-part question. I'm going to go ahead and start and read the first part, then the second, then the third. Please answer in order there. I particularly enjoy the discussion about geopolitical events on the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Therefore, I'd like to ask you some what-if questions. For instance, number one, what is the likely outcome if TPP is implemented, as President Obama has indicated? Dave, we had a program on TPP. We've interviewed people who know more than we do about it. What's your thought?
Well, certainly I would suggest that you go back and listen to the interview that we did with Harold James. We talked not only about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but we also talk about the Transatlantic Partnership as well. And there's things that are beneficial and good about the TPP, and also things that are not so beneficial that seem to favor large multinationals at the expense of smaller businesses in terms of their impunity to investigation and accountability, et cetera. So I think that interview with Harold James would be most helpful looking forward to the TPP. The second part of the question, what is the likely outcome of the U.S. export imports if China effectively shuts down, either to implied war in the South China Sea or an effective collapse of manufacturing inside China, or the yuan is priced out of sight, or any other reason? You know, it's interesting. I think we are in a dependent relationship with the Chinese. They are to us, we are to them. They have continued to buy treasuries, though on a diminished basis, and in certain months they've even liquidated treasuries. Why do they own those treasuries? They own those treasuries because of our export-import relationship. They're willing to recycle their trade dollar surpluses and basically print money to neutralize the inflationary currency effect of running those trade surpluses and invest them in treasuries.
Dave, I have the same question. I mean, is there a breaking point? We think like Westerners, okay? So we see these trade relationships, we see these economic symbiotic relationships as the trump for, you know, keeping peace. But you have a different mindset oftentimes in countries, especially communist countries, where there can be a breaking point that's different than the economic breaking point. I mean, do you see something possibly occurring, you know, in the South China Sea or something geopolitically?
I think we could have a two-tiered relationship that exists in parallel, where we're in some small military skirmish with the Chinese while continuing to import goods from China.
Okay.
Where there's a strained relationship politically, but business as usual kind of continues on from an import-export perspective. They cannot afford to not export. to the United States. They cannot afford to not export to Europe. You would be talking about internal chaos and social political collapse if that were the case. And, you know, when you look at conflict, you have to look at it not in terms of a severing of relationship, but in terms of a more aggressive conversation. You can see that some families are more volatile than others, but certainly you can see tones increase and arguments get to the point where you'd say, gosh, that was really unpleasant. And yet relationship is not broken. And I think that's what you could see in the South China Sea, where we see a tremendous increase in tension, maybe even a lobbing back and forth of missiles. And you think, well, that's got to be an indication of the end of relationship. It's not. From a diplomatic standpoint, every move and countermove is a response and a rejoinder in an ongoing conversation.
Right. And it's interesting how you have different intermediaries. It's almost like a black market that occurs. If it's not politically correct for two countries to do business with each other, sometimes it's through different intermediaries, like the sugar wars a few hundred years ago. And I hate to bring it up, but even like the oil that ISIS is selling that seems to be flowing through Turkey.
Yeah, and could be landing in Japan. The indicators that we have is that it's being sold to Japan. So the third part of that question is, you know, the yuan being priced out of sight. I think that implies the yuan trading up and not down. And the natural course for the yuan seems to be down and not up. That's what they've sort of allowed to happen, is a devaluation of the yuan here in recent months. Mm-hmm. And a part of that is just them limiting the controls that they have on the currency and allowing it to go its more natural course. So there is a third part to Steve's question that we haven't read yet.
Yeah, the third part of the question says the Fed only has three options, to my understanding: continued ZIRP, which is zero interest rate policy, or NERP, which is negative interest rate policy, or to raise interest rates. What is the likely geopolitical outcomes of each of the three possibilities, Dave?
Well, let's start with what has occurred already. We have a 25 basis point move higher from the Fed, and I think it does raise tensions geopolitically, and it does underscore the rest of the world wanting to move to a less dollar-centric and U.S. foreign policy-centric environment. Why? Because our interest rate policy is immediately transmitted into the rest of the world. So we tighten, and it tightens credit globally. And that's not something that is particularly popular, particularly for countries where politicians are already on the ropes. I think of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. She's already in crisis. She's already under pressure. And does this do anything to help the real, the dollar strengthening? Absolutely not. It takes a situation from bad to worse. Who does it help? I think it helps the United States to some small degree, because, again, the interest rate differential between the U.S. Treasury and European paper all of a sudden is that much more attractive. So perhaps you could argue that it draws money into the United States. But keep in mind that sucking sound of money leaving other parts of the world to get to the United States is, for those countries, inherently destabilizing.
So if you impoverish your customers, you may feel like raising the price is okay, but you're impoverishing your customers. They're not going to buy anyway.
Well, what it means is that they're going to be much more skeptical moving forward, right, as to the ties they have to the U.S. dollar, because they see that the flows in can also be the flows out. And those flows out are what are very economically disturbing. And as we know, when you have something that's economically disturbing, it can become politically disturbing, and then it can become geopolitically disturbing.
Okay, so we talked about interest rates rising. Let's go back now. What if that doesn't stick, Dave? I mean, we've seen a quarter of a point rise, but there are those who think that possibly in the next year or two, we're going to see actually a reversal back down, not just to zero, but possibly to negative interest rates.
The intellectual groundwork has already been laid for negative rates, and I think that is the likely outcome over the next 24 to 36 months, is a reversal, of course. And again, 25 basis points is really not even a course. We haven't made much progress towards normalizing interest rates, getting back to 2 or 3%. We're still at 25 basis points, which is barely up off the floor.
Right.
So we are still in what you could consider a zero interest rate environment. Look, in real terms, and this is the important thing, in real terms, when you factor in inflation, you've got 25 basis points, which represent your current interest rate, but then your inflation rate is better than 1.5%, nearly 2%. That's the target. But let's say it's 1.5%.
That's using the Fed's numbers.
In real terms, you're still negative by 1.25%.
Right.
And then the only discussion is, do they take instead of real terms being negative, actually take nominal rates negative. That's where I think we are going. That's dollar negative, which quite frankly offers something of a boost to the emerging markets. And I think would be something of a boon, if you will, to the emerging market political regimes.
This next question is an eternal question, Dave. You know, there's always this balance between technicians and fundamentalists. Let me go ahead and read this from Dennis. He says, I've been listening to the show for several years now, and one of the things that seems most challenging to me is how to balance fundamental analysis, which is the news, with technical analysis, which are the charts. There are those like Robert Prechter who teach and espouse Elliott wave theory as the way forward, while others suggest that a technical analysis is so much silliness playing with the numbers, fitting theory to past and extrapolating it to the future. How do you balance these two very different methods of forward thinking without getting stuck in one or two methods that have worked for you in the past?
Well, let me suggest that these two are not adequate and that they are helpful at certain points, but fundamental analysis gives you some insight into, let's call it, reality. And then technical analysis gives you some picture of trends, and certainly trend extrapolation can be helpful looking backward and suggesting that what has happened in the past as represented in this picture, quote unquote, might be duplicated, because quite frankly, what has not changed through time is human nature. Mm-hmm. So the suggestion that somehow the picture is repeatable over and over again to some degree, I think that is reasonable. There is a third category of analysis that trumps both fundamental and technical, and it's liquidity analysis. Hmm. Liquidity analysis is basically asking the question, how much excess liquidity is flowing into the economy from one or more central banks? And if there is excess liquidity flowing into the global economy or a particular economy, you're going to see asset price inflation. And it doesn't matter what the technicals say. It doesn't matter what the fundamentals say. Those become secondary in a period where there is excess liquidity. When there is deficient liquidity, then you're either resting on the fundamentals of a particular company or a particular economy, in which case, on an absolute basis, you're going to see one economy shine above another. And on a relative basis as well, you begin to see a comparison between the weak and the strong. But again, it doesn't really matter if you are a weak economy, a weak company, a strong company, when the liquidity is flowing and it's sufficient to cover over technical trends and fundamental facts.
You know, that's fascinating. I'd like to do a whole show on that, Dave, sometime if we could. It's just a request. I think this is a new angle, a different way of looking at things. I'm going to go ahead and go with a message from Robert and Teresa of Mesa, Arizona. They've got a question that a lot of people have in their mind. It says, greetings. In light of gold going south, what do you see as a good alternative? We're retired. We're looking for a return on our investment. Do you think energy companies would be good at this time to invest in? Thank you. We enjoy your show.
Well, that's a very good question. One, I think a part of the perception of gold going south is a misperception. And I'm not trying to obscure anything here. It's just to say that the dollar is moving higher as much as gold is moving lower. Because if you recall, priced in other currency terms, mm-hmm. gold is not falling to the same degree or at all priced in those currency terms. So what are we really talking about with the price of gold going down? You can just as easily consider it an increase in the value of the dollar in the short run. So if you're saying to yourself, well, I think the price of the dollar and the stability of the dollar is something that is assured over the next coming years and decades and centuries, then obviously gold has no bearing and no relationship to your financial success in the future. You need to get rid of it. If you think that the dollar, in fact, is on shaky ground, on thin ice, doesn't have much of a future. And that's not to say doesn't have a future, but what I'm suggesting is 1913 to the present, for instance. Under the Fed's auspices, under the Fed's guidance, the dollar's lost 96 to 97% of its purchasing power. Even since the 1950s, we've seen a radical decline in the purchasing power of the dollar. You only have about 5 cents of purchasing power from 1950 forward. So I think what we're really talking about when we look at the value of gold is one benchmark or plumb line, if you will, for dollar purchasing power. So here in the last several years, dollar purchasing power has increased. That may seem counterintuitive given central bank activity, but in point of fact, I think given the amount of chaos in the emerging markets and people fleeing other currencies, the dollar's been the beneficiary. That's more commentary on dollar strength than it is gold weakness.
Man, it's probably an anomaly that is temporary.
Yeah, that doesn't speak to the long-term trend or trajectory of the dollar. As to the question, Robert and Teresa, dealing with energy, I think natural gas is cheap. Yes, oil is cheap, but it's not at a provable low. So I think if you are looking at energy as an entire segment for your allocations, yes, I would start allocating that direction, but I would not make any full commitments. Let me just give you an example. If you thought that ultimately you wanted to have $100,000 in energy-related investments, this would be a good time to begin with $20,000 or $25,000, so 20% to 25% of your total allocation. And I would probably slant that more in the direction of natural gas, with an eye to adding to oil to either a smaller degree now or wait and see. There's structural changes in the oil market, given pricing that we have today, that will be changing. And I think you'll see some of the structural changes in the natural gas market as well. But we've been at lower levels for a longer period of time in the natural gas space.
But like you said, limit your exposure. I mean, it's a volatile area. You don't want to go in hog wild.
Right. Yeah. I would say start with partial commitments and over time add to those. A perfect price doesn't exist, and so a good price does. And I think that what you can improve over time is your average share price in the various energy exposures that you have, and I would dollar cost average in. You could begin now, and I would suggest that by the third quarter of 2016 you might be done with your energy allocations.
Kyle asks the next two-part question. Number one is, are there wealth managers that you recommend, especially for those who don't have much wealth? And then the second part of the question, he says, I really enjoy the financial insights in the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, plus a lot of glimpses we get into the McIlvaney family. Do they have a recommended reading or news source list that covers not only financial stuff, but other realms of values, thoughts, education, politics? Oh boy, Dave, put a quarter in right here. I mean, do you have recommendations for reading or what?
Well, let me start with that, the second question, because, you know, we do have in a resources section on our website some suggested reading. It's a very limited list of books. There might be 50, certainly less than 100 books listed there. And if I had my druthers, I would bore you with hundreds and hundreds of book titles. But understand that not all books are appropriate for all readers. It really depends on what you're interested in, what the questions are that are pressing. And I think you should always read where you're the most curious.
Well, and I would say, Dave, your book that's coming out, talking about glimpses into the McIlvaney family and values and education, your book coming out on intentional families, I think covers a huge degree of bird's eye view to your background and your generational background with the McIlvaneys.
Nothing else represents probably better codification of our values as a family, how we've arrived at them, and the process of reverse engineering that we believe is involved in developing a family that's intentional about becoming something. What is that something? What are the things that you most highly prize? As a person who wants to develop heart, mind, and soul, who wants to understand and appreciate the times that we live in and engage with politics and economics and public policy, et cetera, these are things that you will find glimpses of in Intentional Families. That's the title of the book, Reverse Engineering, A Legacy from Finish to Start. Again, that notion of beginning with an ideal and working backwards towards today's choices and the things that we put in motion to underscore within the family context what our values and highest ideals are. There's another side project that I have in addition to Intentional Families, the book that it's done, it just has to be edited. Oh my Lord, the editing process is a bear. And that is what we've called The Missing Chapter. And The Missing Chapter is a look at economics, politics, entrepreneurship, finance, current events, and it's meant to be sort of dialogue starting for families. It's a curriculum. We've matched it to basically one per week for the school year, so roughly 35, 36 different episodes, 7-minute videos, which are accompanied with a study guide, which explore everything from the roots of ISIS and how to understand the Islamic family, if you will, to understanding the difference between deflation and inflation. And it's broken down in such a way that's intended for parents or grandparents to lead the discussion on these issues around the dinner table.
Right, but it's very much geared toward a younger audience understanding it. So I was thinking after I watched one, I was thinking, gosh, I need to download that study guide and fill it out and actually memorize some of the points, because even though we talk about them all day, I really hadn't had it in the structure that you were putting it into.
Well, and I mean, this is intended to be for a wide range of ages. It's intended to be challenging enough for adult to say, my word, I just learned something. But also empowering, given the nature of the study guide, for them to be able to ask questions sitting around a dinner table and lead a discussion on the points that are in it, so that, you know, they're able to empower someone who's 8, 9, 10 years old on up to 18 years old how to think skillfully and think well about some of the most pressing issues of our day. Again, if you're talking about values and education and politics and economics and entrepreneurship, if these are the kinds of things that are interesting to you, then I think that's a healthy resource. And we're going to, over time, continue to add to, well, this is the last and final side project, maybe the last and final side project I'll ever pick up. I've got about 100 books sitting on my shelf. I've already picked them out, and I'm going to be doing 500 to 700 word summaries of these books. These are books that have really impacted my thinking, and in the coming years, I will be publishing those to, I don't know which website yet, but that will be sort of a helpful thumbnail sketch as to what the book is, why it's important, and it'll allow you to choose if you want to use time and energy to invest in that particular reading project.
The next question is from Brian. He says, would silver have the same chance or likelihood of being confiscated as gold? And how do they determine the value in that transaction? Why not confiscate other metals, copper, platinum, etc.? That's his question, Dave.
Yeah, well, silver is less likely to be confiscated. Part of it is that it is predominantly an industrial metal, and industrial demand will continue not only in medical applications, but in literally tens of thousands of different applications. Controlling the supply is a bit tricky. We have worked through our entire above ground surplus of silver. So what we have coming through now is direct mine supply, and the industrial markets are critically in need of that on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So confiscation of metals would throw a monkey wrench into, I would say, hundreds of different industries that depend on it.
Well, and wouldn't you also say, Dave, that gold is what the central banks use as reserve, and when push comes to shove and you've got monetary, let's say, currency wars going on, gold is generally what's grabbed for that reason. Silver's not really a monetary metal when you get up into the central banking side of things.
Well, that's right. Now, try this on for size, because this is a potential reality. In wartime, we have had not only our government, but every government around the world implement price controls over what are considered to be strategic assets. I mean, strategic assets could be the price of milk or the price of spam. You know, those become strategic assets when they're in limited supply. And so silver, I think, would be far more likely to be under that price control mechanism in the context of war than gold, because again, it's industrial nature and it's needed more now for electronics and other things than ever before. Other metals, they're less likely to be confiscated. I look at the platinum group metal and metals, and just like silver, it's almost an exclusive industrial usage. And again, you look at copper, there's a problem between the value and the mass. I mean, it takes hundreds of tons. And if you're thinking about moving and storing tons, to equal a very small monetary value in the copper market. So price controls, possibly. Confiscation, very low likelihood.
Next question from Alexander in Denver, Colorado. He says, I'm a longtime listener. Everything you and your guests say makes sense. I just don't get one thing. How come the economy is humming along and has been for so many years? And all my friends say that I'm just a fool.
Well, I feel that I'm rather in the same boat. Alexander, I would make the contrast between a normal economic recovery and one that is artificially stimulated. And I would also make a contrast between the growth that we've seen, which has been in the financial arena and not in the broader economy. So when we talk about there being segments within the economy, you have the industrial segment, you have the service segment, you have the financial segment. And the reality is that the interventions of the last 5 to 10 years by various world central banks have brought about an amazing financial recovery. But it has not brought around a recovery in the normal economy, in the industrial economy, in the services economy, et cetera, et cetera. So the result is that you have the perception of recovery, but the reality, depending on what segment of the economy you exist in, can be very different.
So if you're a bank president, you've had a recovery. But if you're somebody who makes a widget or a Caterpillar tractor, you have not had a recovery.
Yeah, so I think things are not always as they seem. So friends may say, oh, you've played the part of the fool in this. And I think quite to the contrary, they're playing the part of the fool and you the part of the wise man, in the sense that things are not always as they seem. To buy headlines and to buy the jargon coming from a CNBC and a Bloomberg, that all as well, is to either hold your nose or close your eyes and shut off your mind to a good number of inputs which suggest otherwise.
Next question says, I don't get currency manipulation. If China is keeping the value of the yuan so low to boost exports, isn't the market going to compensate somewhere else somehow? Can they do it forever?
Well, keep in mind, China keeping the value of their currency at a low level and we accusing them of currency manipulation, their currency is pegged to the U.S. dollar. There are dozens of other currencies around the world that are pegged to the U.S. dollar, and we generally don't whine about all of those other currencies being currency manipulators. The hallmark of 2015 has been the People's Bank of China, the PBOC, letting go of that dollar peg to some degree, letting their currency go where the market wants to take it, which, interestingly enough, is towards lower levels. And that's not a result of the PBOC, the People's Bank of China. The perceived value of their currency is at a lower level, and that's where it's drifting as we speak. There's also the peg, which we just described, which is in the process of changing.
Yeah, they're changing to a basket of currencies, commodities, what have you, but it's going to be different than just pegging to the dollar.
And
right?
It may be a transformation which takes several years, but the dollar peg is going to be a past tense issue. The market compensating for it, you know, I think there is a balancing act that's always occurring and an arbitrage that investors are always taking advantage of. And you do see that. You see that in the currency markets. You see that in the tradable goods sectors. For instance, if things are out of whack and the currency in China is too high, their goods are simply priced out of the market and you can buy the same goods from Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. So markets adjust rapidly to undervaluation and overvaluation.
The next question from Gary says, I've heard that there are reports of a major bank that's accumulated a large position in the COMEX silver market. Are you aware of such? And if that were the case, how might you see that affecting the silver market and prices?
Important to recognize that banks do operate their own books of business. In other words, they're trading for their own accounts. But the larger portion of their exposures are positions, which are typically futures positions, and they represent positions held for clients. So they're on the books of the bank, but they are representative of their broad client base. And so building a position, either long or short, isn't necessarily what the bank itself is doing, but what they're doing for other people. What I don't like to see here, Gary, is that an institutional interest in the metals is typically a more fickle interest in the metals. Investors who are interested in the physical metals themselves typically are stronger hands with a rationale for holding it, whereas institutional interests can literally from one day to the next shift. And so I consider them to be much less reliable. What is there today could be gone tomorrow. It's unpredictable in terms of its addition to price trends. So again, the fickle nature of those interests is not something that I'm encouraged by.
The second part of his question says, in hearing reports that the commodities are pretty much in a deflationary environment, explain for us what you see during this period for the gold price.
Well, appreciate this. The best environment for gold to be in as an investor, and this will be very counterintuitive, is a deflationary environment. And it's for this reason. On a relative basis, your relative gains in terms of what you're able to purchase with an ounce of gold in the context of deflation tend to be substantial. And when you look at the equation on a net of tax basis, it's far more compelling to be in a deflationary environment than an inflationary environment where prices are driven higher across the board. And you may, in fact, improve your purchasing power in an inflationary environment holding gold. But remember that whatever price you have in terms of an ounce of gold, a good significant percentage is going to be given to Uncle Sam when you liquidate it to translate it into other assets.
And just look, Dave, I mean, the tax advantage is huge, but even if you didn't have the tax advantage, look at how much more copper gold buys. Even though gold's come down, look at how much more copper gold buys right now and how much more gasoline, how much more oil. We can go right on down the list. And actually, gold has been rising relative to most of those deflationary commodities.
Priced in gold, some of these other assets are in a deflationary funk, and gold has been a great way of preserving and increasing purchasing power. You know, I spoke at a Harry Dent conference a number of years ago, and he had me speak on deflation and the risks of gold in a deflationary context. And what I pointed out very clearly, and it's interesting because all his writing since then has completely ignored the facts and the historical documentation that I provided at his conference to him and all the attendees, 600 years of market data, including both U.S. and British market data, show gold increasing your purchasing power in every deflation.
Without exception, right?
A minimum of 45%. The max was in the 1930s of 240, almost 250%. Could you see a loss in nominal terms? Yes, you could. On a relative basis, did you improve your purchasing power for the kinds of things that you lived your life on the basis of? Yes. In fact, you improved your position financially, a minimum of close to 50%, a maximum of close to 250%. Gold did its job in the context of a deflation. Unfortunately, he's an economist that's all wet when it comes to reading history. I don't know that he knows how to. It's an interesting thing because deflation is actually the preferred environment for a gold owner. And again, keep that in mind. On a net tax basis, gold goes to 5,000. You're going to give up a third of your gains to Uncle Sam before you start translating from one asset to another. That puts you at a tremendous disadvantage. In the context of deflation, you may in fact have a tax write-off in the nominal loss, but increase your financial footprint 2, 3, 4-fold.
There's a concept, Dave, of who are your friends and who are your enemies. It's a good way of figuring out what side you should take. And actually, who really wants to see inflation? Honest to goodness, the central banks are the ones who are telling us we need inflation. The people who are getting lower and lower prices for everything, that actually is a bonus. A deflation in the end is for the people.
No, that's exactly right. You're exactly right. The whole narrative has been corrupted. And the idea that we should be afraid of deflation neglects the value of your money buying more stuff.
Right.
The Treasury has a vested interest in seeing the Fed improve the inflation statistics. Why? Because they get to increase their tax take every year.
Mm-hmm.
Consider this. In a deflationary environment, if the few dollars that you make buy more stuff, it's the equivalent of getting a pay increase without an increase in taxation. That doesn't work for central bankers. That doesn't work for central planners.
I think that actually answers, Dave, a little bit of the third part of Gary's question. He says, for those people we all know that don't believe in the value of precious metals and do believe in the value of stocks and bonds, how would you recommend that we might explain to them the basis for the metals' superior value during uncertain times?
Well, I think you start with acknowledging that no one knows the future, and therefore it's important to have multiple strategies in play. Precious metals are a defensive strategy and a very good one. What we do know about human behavior is that it behaves in a certain way when faced with uncertainty. People seek to have greater and greater control in that context, and they want physical control, if they can get it, of the assets in question, as much as they can, wherever they can. So in times of uncertainty, all of a sudden you find precious metals in that defensive strategy representing almost the best offense, the defense being the best offense, where gains are had as people clamor for greater degrees of control. So I would put it in the context of, listen, no one knows the future, and you certainly need a defensive strategy right next to an offensive strategy. Makes sense to have both. That's how I would position it for someone who's a naysayer in terms of the gold market.
Next question from Chris. You know, sort of tongue in cheek, Dave. I mean, he wants to see what a lot of people want to see, and that's gold and silver come up. He says, I have a very profound and intellectual question. Ha ha. When is silver going to get out of the basement and gold along with it as well? I mean the price. Okay. I'm sure I'm the only one to ask that question. And then he says,
thank you, Chris. I mean, I think one of the things that you need to understand is that humor is essential.
Yeah.
Without it, we tend to take ourselves and circumstances too seriously. And certainly in the office, we have a certain sort of macabre humor that has kept us sane, functional, healthy, working together as a team for over 43 years now. And so, Chris, I appreciate the humor there. It is a profound intellectual question. When is the price going up? I think it ties to three different things: a confidence in the Fed, inflation expectations, and Dow pricing. Confidence in the Fed, that gives way to people having to reappraise the basis of which all assets have been priced here in recent years. And when confidence caves, I think you're dealing with a complete reappraisal of the marketplace, and gold all of a sudden is center stage, having more value than it currently does. Inflation expectations, again, the inflation number doesn't have to change. It's the trajectory that people think that we're now on. And if people think the future is going to have more inflation than the present, that expectation, quote unquote, is what drives interest in the price of gold. And last, I think Dow pricing. As the Dow goes up, people consider a defensive strategy to be irrelevant. Who needs it when you could be making a lot more money with your money? I came out of a meeting with our local college here. We help advise the management of their assets. And I was advising, we were given a gift of about $1.5 million. I was advising that it sit in cash for the next year. And everyone said, oh no, we couldn't do that. We would be losing. You're going to lose either way. We could lose if we're in the stock market, but you're certainly going to lose sitting in cash because you're not going to receive any income. And I thought it was interesting because there's this perception that we can't afford to be out of the market.
Right.
We can't afford to be out of the market. And that sentiment is very frail. That sentiment changes rapidly. But what you see in the Dow Jones Industrial Average is really a litmus, a cultural litmus for health in the economy. If it's up 300 points, track this on a daily basis. Next time you're sitting around the water cooler at the office, wherever you happen to work, if the Dow's up 300 points, gauge what sentiment is for the economy. I can almost guarantee you it's positive.
Right.
Dow's down 300 points, guess what? You're going to tap certain underground insecurities of people saying, yeah, I do have some concerns. And literally, from one day to the next, the movement in the Dow, which to me is a very false signal as to the course ahead, is going to tell you what people think and how they feel.
Well, and Dave, you know, I just go back to 1987, my first year here. 87 was a year that people couldn't afford to not be in the market. And then after it crashed, you heard the same thing. We can't afford to be in the market. Happened in 87. It happened in the year 2000. It happened in 2007. Probably is going to happen in the next year or two again, where the people who could not afford to not be in the market, they sell at the very bottom because they can't afford to be in the market after this sentiment changes.
Right. And I would say this, Chris, one of the things that's important as an investor is to bring patience into the equation. Why? Because patience is inextricably linked to time. And time turns big things into little things. So a concern about the present price of gold, time will turn that concern into a very little concern. I watched this special the other day on the creation of sand. It was about a 2-minute, I don't know if it's a TED talk or what it was, on sand. And time turns big things into little things. I was listening to that and I'm thinking, yes, that's right. You know, a granite peak is turned to a seashore over a long period of time. The big things are turned into little things, and time is the equation. I think our concerns too, as big as they are in the moment, add time. And I think you'll find the stress of underperformance, that will go away too.
You know, on a similar note, Darlene asks, how much will so much global conflict affect portfolios heavily weighted in precious metals and oil and natural gas?
Yeah. Well, these are emotional assets, and higher levels of conflict, with higher levels of conflict and greater concern, what you end up with is the question of how will these commodities be delivered to the market? Think of all the geographic choke points. You've got the Straits of Malacca, Hormuz, the Cape Point, and you've got the Panama Canal. These are all places that geographically, with the right amount of global conflict, all of a sudden delivery of vital assets becomes a real question.
They're choke points at that point.
They are choke points, and the economies cannot exist without fossil fuels today. That may not be the case 50 years from now, but it certainly is the case today. And precious metals are similarly emotional, although they're not vital as oil and natural gas are to the healthy functioning of an economy. So the last point I'd make on precious metals is that, as I mentioned in the last question, there's a desire for protection. There's a desire for control. When you see global conflict increase, people want more control of their assets. They want protection. They want portability. They want something that they can do something with that's outside the system. The classic case in point is the Russians rolling through Afghanistan in 79 and sheiks in the Middle East saying to themselves, black gold's fine, but I better load the 747 with kilo bars and 400 ounce good delivery bars and get it to Switzerland because it may be the only thing that helps me rebuild. And it's not the way the Saudis and those in the Middle East ordinarily think, but the plan B is, do I have something that gives me control, gives me protection, gives me the ability to, again, with portability, take it where I need to be, away from where I no longer want to be. So I think, again, this notion of an increase in global conflict does underscore the importance of precious metals moving forward.
The next question pertains to a cashless society coming. Frank and Anne ask the question, what should we be doing now to get ready for cash being outlawed in the future?
What can you own that is like cash? Is the question that I would ask. Gold and silver represent a bridge asset to a new currency. And you don't know what that new currency may be officially. And gold and silver represent a very good bridge. We worked with a gentleman for years by the name of Klaus Bucher. And you know, he had lived through the German hyperinflation.
Right.
And he explained to us that the currency for his family and what enabled his family to get through...
The cellar full of vodka.
That's right. Maybe you fill in what your cash equivalent is in terms of cigarettes, feminine products, you know, chickens that lay eggs, cows that give milk and calves, rabbits that can reproduce very quickly and represent a protein source. I mean, these are all assets that have currency-like characteristics in the context of a crisis. So if you're asking the question about the outlawing of cash, then I'm asking you the question of what represents black market capital and all of these things and more. Let your imagination run wild and imagine at a practical level what you need, what you would want, and that's what you should have now in advance of other people asking the same question.
Okay, this next question is about the flat tax. I've been listening to all the debates, both Republican and Democrat parties. Some of the candidates talk about doing away with the IRS and replacing it with a 10 to 20% flat tax. In your opinion, Dave, can a flat tax be enough to sustain our country?
Yes, if you do away with all deductions and if you bring corporations in and keep them on the hook where they have the same effective tax rate as everyone else. With deductions and with the ability to create sort of, whether it's the double Irish or different tax strategies that corporations use to sequester earnings and keep them overseas, that allows them to lower their effective tax rate into the low single digits. So, you know, you look at a group like Apple, you look at a group like General Electric, does it surprise you to learn that their effective tax rate is less than 10%, that their effective tax rate in some years is negative, and the U.S. government actually sends them a check for being in business for the year? That may seem insane, but that kind of behavior should be done away with. If it is done away with, then a flat tax applied to every man, woman, child corporation in the country, including on their foreign earned income, yes, I think it would absolutely work and it would simplify the code tremendously.
So done right, you would be a fan.
Yes.
Next question. Do you believe the federal government will eventually take over IRAs and 401ks?
There are circumstances under which they would, but I think that that is a long way off. The notion of crisis compressing time is something that you always have to keep in mind. In the context of crisis, that far off, almost impossible event may become a real-time issue. I think the answer is to stay aware and stay awake. We're not at a state yet where fiscal policy measures have been exhausted. You know, we have one of the lowest tax rates at present in U.S. history. We are well below the average tax rates of the last 150 to 200 years in terms of U.S. tax collection. So I think before they start ruining their credibility, confiscating taxways in a non-traditional way, you're going to see them increase taxes considerably, which is theft the more traditional way. So again, don't look for them to do things that are out of the box until they've exhausted all their options in the box, and they're a long way from that.
Next question, Dave, would you agree that bank deposits are liabilities to the bank, and only when some of these deposits are lent out do they become assets to that bank? Deficits run by governments and the $4.5 trillion Fed liability have crowded out bank lending, and the banks are refusing to accept large deposits by individuals and businesses.
Yes, I would agree with the first part of that. The second part is that a lot of loans are not being made because the incentive is not there. Not only do you have to meet a very high bar at this point in terms of qualifying for a loan, but banks can redeposit their funds with the Fed and be earning risk-free 50 basis points, that is a half of 1%, doing nothing. So you get money virtually for free from the Fed, give it back to them, and collect extra interest on money that's not even yours. And I think what you're dealing with is a very corrupted lending system to begin with. The most important thing of this first move by the Fed in recent weeks has been the increase in the payment on interest held as excess reserves at the Federal Reserve. That proves more than anything that Janet Yellen is a puppet and that she is not in control of the Fed any longer. What is very obvious is that the folks that make the decisions as to the payments made, it's a five-member team, including Stanley Fisher, that decide what interest is paid on excess reserves, they're the ones who are influencing the yield curve. They're the ones who are influencing ultimately lending from the banks and ultimately the drip system into the larger economy.
Next question is from the Netherlands. He says, hello from the Netherlands. Thanks again for the podcast. When will McIlvaney accept Bitcoin as a payment method? And can you do a podcast on Bitcoin? Well, Dave, we did do a podcast on Bitcoin when we interviewed George Gilder.
That's right. And we had a fascinating conversation also with the gentleman that runs PricedInGold.com. He's been very enthusiastic about owning Bitcoin. It's nice having a cost basis in the single digits, and he was very early in the Bitcoin issue. And so, yes, we will do one there. I'm also on the advisory committee for a company that is a blockchain startup. So we are working on moving towards receiving Bitcoin as a payment method here at McIlvaney. But our challenge thus far has been there is no way to effectively hedge our quote-unquote currency risk in Bitcoin. So when we can figure out how to hedge our currency risk in Bitcoin, we will address that as a payment method.
Well, and that brings us to the next question. I would love to hear you do a show on the war on cash and cryptocurrency. I believe Bitcoin will either be taken over or put out by the government, as the government does not like competition. They want to control every aspect of your life and monitor every transaction you do. Do you agree with that, Dave? What's your thought on the takeover of Bitcoin by, say, a government entity?
Well, on the one hand, it's been encouraging to see Wall Street firms take a greater interest in the blockchain technology, which is the basis of Bitcoin. On the other hand, you think, well, if Wall Street's involved, the government's not far behind. And so co-opting and sort of creating a backdoor look at the ownership is something that would be a key of sort of Wall Street and Washington sorting out the use and or control of that technology. What Wall Street is likely to do is create their own version, taking the technology, adding a few bells and whistles that are government approved, and rolling out something that is marketable and accepted to a general audience. I think it will lose some of its value if that is the case, because a part of what people appreciate about Bitcoin, about cash, about gold is the ability to transact business on a private basis. And it's being cast in society today as a bad thing to have privacy. This is the only time in world history where privacy has been something that is assumed to be evil. Oh yeah, no, that's not true. Every time you've been dealing with a statist government in the history of the world, they have viewed privacy as something that is evil. So there is that recurrent theme of statists of all persuasion not only don't like gold, but anything that smacks of your ability to move and act independently or quietly outside of the system. So I like Bitcoin for what it is today. We'll have to see what it morphs into tomorrow and what merits it still maintains.
Next question says, should I cash my savings in and buy silver and food supply? Pretty simple question, Dave.
Yes and no. It's a question of degrees. How much is too much? How much is too much silver? How much is too much gold? How much is too much food? I mean, with food, you've got sort of a use-by date issue, so you wouldn't sort of load up on that. After 25 years, all the food that you've purchased is no better than dog kibble, so you don't want to necessarily have too much, but decide how much does make sense. I wouldn't cash in my savings entirely. You know, however it's invested, it does give you a broader exposure to other things, other investments, other asset classes. Cash in itself is an asset class, underappreciated. But yes, I would own some silver. Yes, I would have some gold. Yes, I would have some silver. Yes, I would have a minimum of a month or two's food supply for every member in the family. These are just practical things, and I don't think you need to overdo it. So yes, and no, it is a question of degrees.
Okay, so the next question says, do you see banks shutting down sometime in the near future? Also, do you think U.S. treasuries are still safe?
The simple answer to that is no, I don't see banks shutting down in the near future. They feed the economy and support the vast majority of activity in the economy via debit card transactions, credit card transactions, settlement of payroll. And so there is no economy without banks today, unless you're talking about sort of a nuts and bolts barter economy. So it's not in the interest of government to do that. You would see a destabilization politically, socially, as a result of the economic destabilization of losing the banking system. The second part I would say is that using them will become more and more expensive, that is banks. And I think you're going to see non-bank alternatives arise. So let me give you an example. Let's say that a certain gift card gives you a 5% discount on purchases. Well, listen, buying those gift cards as a short-term cash alternative allows you to have a quote-unquote cash alternative and collect the equivalent of 5% interest in a zero interest rate environment. So, you know, people who all over the world are constantly looking at things that don't quite make sense but are to their advantage. And that would be an example of creating a cash deposit, quote unquote, outside the banking system in a way that, just like a zero coupon bond, has implicit interest to it. So I think people are going to discover these opportunities, and corporations will create more and more of them as the cost of modern day banking goes up. So would it surprise me at all to see Walmart start issuing these kinds of cash cards and see people buying them up as an alternative to sitting in a bank deposit with zero interest? You're moving your cash to Walmart instead of to your local bank and getting implicit interest as well.
Well, how about the question on treasuries, Dave? Do you still believe in buying U.S. treasuries, government debt?
Yes, for now. 10-year maturity or less, 5 years preferable. In there, you're dealing with some interest rate volatility. So let's look at a hypothetical. Let's say that equities sell off 25% or more this next year in 2016. What happens to the yield on 10-year treasuries? It would drop, let's say, from a theoretical 2.25% to 1.75%. And as you know, as interest rates decline, the price of those bonds go up. You could actually see a 10-year treasury or a 5-year treasury be a profit center, a capital gain creator, even though the interest is, you know, modest, 2%. That, to me, does make sense as a diversification. And I do expect to see quite a bit of volatility in the equity market this next year. So as long as your maturities are at the shorter end of the curve, I think in the short run, they still make sense. In the long term, no way. I mean, if you had to say, well, Dave, are you going to hold those treasuries for the next 10 or 15 years? Absolutely not. What I'm talking about is a short-term liquid position in capital, in fixed income, that I'm probably going to liquidate within the next 2 to 3 years after that benefit has been accumulated. A drop in rates and an increase in the value of those bonds, I'll be happy to take that capital gain to the bank.
Next question from Sally. I heard that there was a proposal to make it illegal to hold gold and silver in safe deposit boxes. I can't find confirmation of that, but feel it's smart not to use safe deposit boxes. What are your thoughts?
Well, banks ask you not to do that already. If you read the paperwork for any bank, when you're filling out and signing up for a bank box, they don't want you putting anything in there other than, you know, house title, car title, et cetera, et cetera. For some people, it remains the best option. It remains the best option either because you travel a lot or because you have a high profile in your community.
Or if you live in an apartment in Chicago or someplace where there's really no place to hide something.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in recent weeks, we've talked about the number of burials of gold throughout France and continental Europe and Britain. And I think that's the reality, is that for most people, burying their gold, that's what they have done through the millennia. Banks didn't exist and offer us that opportunity. I like it as an alternative. Is it perfect? No. But again, this is where thinking flexibly, make sure that you have more than one strategy in play all the time. Have a part of your gold held overseas. Have a part of your gold in your possession at home. Have a part of it in the bank. Don't try to play the genius and pretend to know more than you do. You don't know how this is going to play out. And I think having multiple strategies in play is important.
Kathy asks, how will we know when it's time to sell our precious metals, and what do we purchase in exchange, and how quickly can the selling and purchasing take place?
I look at this as an exchange of stuff for stuff, one resource for another kind of resource. It's a value exchange. So if you have, and try to do this, if you see your precious metals as cash, it's not what price are the precious metals. That's the wrong way to look at it. It's what can I get for them? In other words, what am I exchanging them for directly or indirectly, and is it a compelling value exchange? So how long does it take is the last part of that question. Well, I was witness when I was 6 years old to a young man that worked for our company at the time, and he took a cookie tin full of silver dimes and exchanged them for a Trans Am. And it was the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. I was absolutely riveted by this cookie tin full of silver dimes being exchanged for one of the coolest cars imaginable for a six-year-old.
Sure.
A convertible Trans Am, you know, with the big eagle on the front hood and everything. So in that instance, the exchange was instant. In the case of a house or land, it could be days to weeks. As fast as you can work through the change in title and the escrow process. If you're talking about moving from gold and silver to stocks and bonds, it's days. It's a question of how long it takes you to turn it into cash and that cash to instantly be turned into stocks and bonds. And then, of course, it's an instant exchange when you're coming out of gold and moving into the currency of your choice. If you don't like the currency of the realm, you could certainly choose Canadian dollars, Australian dollars, the Mexican peso, the Indonesian rupiah. It doesn't matter what it is. You know, when you're going from precious metals to currencies, that's an instant exchange. So again, to me, it boils down to this, not what price are the precious metals and therefore we're moving out and moving on, but what is the value exchange when I go from my stuff to that other stuff, whatever that other stuff is, that is of value to you.
This next question, you may have already answered aspects of the question, but I'm going to go ahead and read it because it also deals with offshore storage. He says, with the threat of possible terrorist or unfriendly government attacks against our country, such as EMP, etc., how should our investments be diversified? Options include offshore banking, precious metals stored offshore, a second home in another country, etc. Obviously, we must continue praying for God's protection for our country against all of these possibilities.
Well, thanks, Ron. It's good to hear from you. If it was EMP, remember how much your world would shrink. And the question then would be, what do you have access to? Is the grid down? Do you have transportation? Does your car function, given the fact that all of its electronics have been fried? How do you get offshore if you need to? I mean, there's certain scenarios where the offshore options are irrelevant, whether
right.
It's storing metals or having a second home or whatever. It becomes irrelevant because you can't get there. So I would say do all of the above. Offshore banking, precious metals, a second home abroad, et cetera, et cetera. Do all of the above, but remember that your local resources may be all that you can access for several months or for an indefinite period of time. So keep in mind what you have close at hand, including the relationships that you have close at hand, which are going to be far more of a resource to you than practically anything else.
Well, and you can take that to whatever extreme you want, because we have a gentleman who works here, Dave, named Chuck, who keeps 3 to 5 different ways to start a fire on his person at all times. So now I couldn't start a fire with anything in my pocket right now, but you know, if you need something to create a flame. Chuck's the guy you call. So I guess you'd probably need to know, part of your list would be know who Chuck is in the area, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. Relationships do matter.
Next question from Steve. He says, why were the banking rules changed last November by the G20 countries? He goes on to say, why has the Federal Reserve System been allowed to operate in secrecy for these past 100 years?
Well, it's interesting. The changes at the G20 change really the relationship between the depositor and the banking institution in a fairly dramatic fashion. And without most depositors knowing it, they are now way down the list of people who have access or right to their own money. In the case of a bank going under or going into bankruptcy, being dissolved, you have creditors, which are now categorized as a higher priority than depositors. I mean, consider that. Whose money is in the bank? But a creditor being prioritized over a depositor, what this suggests is that the G20 and the banking community as a whole is very aware of the frailty within our financial system. And they're also very aware of how important it is to take care of creditors within the financial system. They're not interested in seeing a derivative domino implosion. So that, I think, is what you're seeing with the G20, is in advance of a major catastrophe, they're putting the depositor on the line rather than those who are central to the banking community. So I think you know full well the macro level answer is, in very broad terms, central planning is easiest to achieve under certain conditions. We have central banking, which has enabled a huge growth in government by financing growth via the printing presses and very accommodative financing rates. And it's created unhealthy growth. It's created unstable growth. It's created something that can implode on itself. And they're now trying to figure out ways to prop up the world that they've created.
Well, in the second part of the question, Dave, probably was answered by your first answer. I mean, the banking community, obviously, all decisions are not for the preservation of the depositor. It's for the preservation of the banking community and the power that they hold. It just seems that over the last 100 years, this creature from Jekyll Island, as one of our guests has called it, has not only operated in secrecy, but always for its own self-preservation.
Well, that's right. If we take care of the few, we will take care of the many, I think would be the credo of the central bank community. So if it seems self-interested, they've spun it in their own heads as something that's actually quite generous to the rest of the world. And it may be punishing and harmful to the many in the short run. But again, you take care of the few, the best, the brightest, the most well-connected, and they will be able to rebuild a world from the rubble. And that's really the attitude that they operate within. I think that if people understood the corruption, which has been implicit to the central banking community, we would have it dissolved in a heartbeat. And I say that from a historical perspective, not even from current events, because it was with the first central bank of the United States and the second central bank of the United States that the populace began to see how interconnected Wall Street and Washington had become via the central bank, via the nation's bank. And they said, you know what, we're going to end the charter. This is just not good. We have politicians wetting their beaks in very corrupt and unsavory ways, and we've got to put an end to this political corruption via the U.S. bank. And now we have the third iteration of that. If people understood how corruption is catered to via the central bank, we would do away with the third. And I think that's why they have existed and continue to operate largely in secrecy over the last 100 years.
Bruce says, in your commentary, you spoke about the cautious ducks who did not land. Remember your duck hunting analogy.
That's right.
In other words, what action should we take to protect ourselves in the coming financial environment? I've been reading and hearing about an impending financial crisis. There was talk of a stock market crash in October that really didn't happen. What has kept this from occurring, and when do you think it will occur? I realize setting dates is foolish, but a general sense with the information you have would be appreciated.
Sure. Well, with reference to sort of total net worth, the cautious duck is someone who's going to avoid stocks or reduce to a minimal exposure, let's say 10 to 25% max. The cautious duck is the one who's raising cash, sitting on cash, looking at money market funds and short-term treasuries, separated across small and dispersed bank deposits. In other words, keeping under $100,000 minimum. I realize 250 is the official number, but I would go back to the pre-crisis number of 100. And so you're dispersed across several financial institutions, maintaining FDIC insurance. insurance for whatever that's worth. And I would, for the cautious duck, also have a solid gold and silver position. For those who are less cautious, the posture looks something like this. The non-cautious duck is landing and saying to themselves, I find value in equities, and I want it to be 40 to 60% of my net worth. They're saying I want to minimize cash because it pays nothing. And they're saying that I would like to avoid metals because they're cheap and they're likely to get cheaper. And no one likes cheap things. I would disagree with the non-cautious duck on that. I think quite the opposite. Fortunes are made buying things when they're not priced to the moon and selling them when they are priced to the moon. So on that basis, again, equities, you've got to put a question mark. But here again is a cautious duck interposing his opinions onto the non-cautious.
So the careless duck gets eaten and the cautious duck lives to quack another day.
That's right. Well, and I think to the last part of that question in terms of dates, you're right. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, so adding any dates to the equation guarantees some degree of humiliation. Maybe that's good for my character development. But I would say that from now to the end of 2016, we continue to see sort of a trend change as investors take into stride, take into mind what it means to be raising rates in 2017. I think that by mid-year 2017, I think you've got a very tough environment because as much as the Fed would like to perhaps even reverse course in the face of recessionary trends, which I think emerge between now and then, you've got something of a political handcuffing which has occurred. Does the Fed operate dovishly or hawkishly with now just months leading to the election? So again, just to cap that idea, because of the political handcuffing in 2016, I think by mid-year 2017, you're talking about a very tough go for the economy, regardless of verbal or actual intervention from the Fed. Why do I say that? Well, just to cap this, profits peaked in 2015, and we began to see a decline year on year for corporations. Corporations for all of 2015 have done their best to pretty up the pig, and via financial engineering, whether it's share buybacks or an increase in debt to, you know, do various things like share buybacks, improve the picture to the general public. Meanwhile, we've seen a decline in revenues, a decline in sales on a very broad basis, and cracks creeping into the credit system. So I think, quite frankly, 2016 could be a year of complete chaos. If we're able to escape it, 2017 seems to me to be an inevitable comeuppance.
Robin writes, many are saying the greatest wealth transfer in history is about to occur. One mentioned corporate bonds as where that may happen. I'm a single mother on a set income and have acquired precious metals as a safeguard against the falling dollar. I have great reservations about investing in the markets. Exactly what kind of investments are they referring to with this great wealth transfer? And do you recommend these types of investments?
Well, I agree in terms of the greatest transfer in history. I believe that you're well positioned between cash and precious metals. The wealth transfer is from high valued popular assets, ultimately becoming assets which are diminished in value. And the transfer occurs when cash and gold buy you, the cautious duck, multiples of those assets at much cheaper prices. The win here is in expanding your financial footprint. And this means keeping things liquid. This means having assets which are cautiously positioned today. And the wealth transfer, again, is, I think, from the overly optimistic being surprised, and perhaps the overly pessimistic having opportunities of a lifetime if they are in fact willing to make some mid-course corrections as time goes on. For the overly pessimistic, they might even miss the opportunity as they stay too long in a cash and precious metals position.
This next question asks about stock certificates being delivered. Spencer says, should an individual have stock certificates delivered out of their brokerage account to be held privately in case something should happen to the financial system? And how would that be accomplished?
Perhaps, but I would suggest that you're losing a tremendous amount of liquidity. A lot can take place. If you ever want to have those brought back into the system, transfer agents, which are responsible for the disbursement of those stock certificates and receiving them back in to verify that they're legitimate and then have them put on deposit with a brokerage firm, they're penalizing that kind of behavior. And so I think you're looking at certainly two, as many as 4 weeks from start to finish in either direction. So it's going to take you some time to do it. It'll also take you some time to get back into the system. And again, I think I prize liquidity with liquid assets. The only assets that I would give up liquidity on would be things like a privately held business or real estate. Otherwise, whether it's cash, gold, securities, I'm going to favor the liquidity elements there. And just note that you shouldn't be over-invested in those asset classes. And if you are, then make the mid-course correction by reducing your exposure rather than eliminating the liquidity variable there. In the second part of the question, how would that be accomplished? Brokers order them out. You would just call a broker and have them ordered out.
The next question from Lionel. Yeah, he says, the world is deeply in debt. I've never owned any debt, and I don't know anyone who has owned debt. My question is, who owns all this debt? So, Dave, I think maybe sometimes people assume debt is something different than it is, but even the U.S. dollar is owning a form of debt, is it not? I mean, if you have dollars in your pocket, it's an instrument.
It's an IOU. So who owns the debt? The banking system. So from the top down, the central bank, next in line, your commercial banks. And somewhere, either before or immediately after the commercial banks, are your non-traditional financiers, what's known as shadow banking. And all the debt really just equals an income-producing asset to them. You put out an IOU and you start collecting a revenue stream on the basis of that. You've got central banks that are something like the Praetorian guards of the banking system, and they're the ones who make sure that it exists and survives another day. Why? Well, because quite frankly, it's fun to collect interest.
This last question from Francis. My question is, what can I do to further protect my precious metals IRA besides following the advice that you all give for buying and selling and maintaining my precious metals in a depository? Protection from the federal fingers is my main concern. Secondary to that is access in a less functional financial world. In other words, I'm saying access limitations. Thank you for your assistance.
Well, let's work with what we know versus what we don't know. We know that retirement accounts are tax benefited for a short period of time. And at some point in the future, you're going to have a huge tax hit, believed by some to be a smaller tax hit because perhaps your income tax bracket is less in retirement. And so there's a benefit to waiting and paying taxes on those assets then versus now. My suggestion is this. One of the most effective tax strategies that you can employ today, if it is possible to take your IRA and convert it to a Roth, it gives you protection against an increase in the tax consequences to precious metals if it's ever disadvantaged further. And it also locks in at what are traditionally low tax rates today versus what I think is virtually guaranteed higher tax rates tomorrow. So a conversion from a traditional to a Roth is something that I would very much consider if you're able to do that. And I think the biggest risk is a tax risk. It's not a confiscation risk when you're talking about precious metals. It's much easier for the federal government to say, hey, listen, everybody's got trillions of dollars in a 401k. They don't have to look like the bad guys by going after retirees and going after that pocket of assets. They get to do it implicitly if they raise tax rates.
Right.
If they move the entire spectrum of tax rates and the top effective rate goes from the upper 30s, let's say, to the upper 50s, which keep in mind, it was in the low 90s, less than 100 years ago, the top effective tax rate was about 93-94%. So they will get what they want and they will do it. They will fleece you, but they don't have to appear to be the bad guy doing it. Circumstances will mitigate changing the tax code. Paying Social Security payments will require them to change the tax levels for income brackets and whatnot. And I think one of the best things that you can do is not yank it out of a retirement account, but convert it to a Roth where it's still protected from tax implications moving forward and guarantees that whatever benefit you have from appreciation of the assets internal, you get it tax-free. You've basically said, I'll take my current tax rate and be done with taxes forever.
So the second part of the question, Dave, had to do with, you know, if the financial system's breaking down, maybe the markets are dysfunctional. Is there a problem with access to that IRA?
Well, I think if you really want to, if push came to shove, you could organize and schedule a trip to Delaware and actually pick up product. We're not dealing with phantom product or paper IOUs.
It's not a zero or a one on a computer screen.
No.
It actually physically has weight.
When you're paying annual fees, it's for storage of real allocated metals. There has been a trend in the industry to suggest that you can somehow take those assets into your physical possession and maintain them inside an IRA structure. And I'll tell you that that notion of privatizing IRAs is something that is, in our opinion, a very bad idea. We have an industry letter, both the bank and trust industry dealing with retirement assets, but also letters from the IRS, which would suggest that these are taxable events. And so a conversion to a Roth, that's a tax event, but it leaves you in a tax-advantaged position. Keep in mind that, in all likelihood, in the context of an audit, you'll have penalties, you'll have taxes, and you're likely, in addition to the taxes paid and the penalties paid, you're likely to retain maybe 10 to 15% of your retirement assets. So I think you're taking a huge risk in order to remove the protection from federal fingers, as many in the industry have recommended. One last thing on that, because I think the motives need to be clear. For most people who are recommending that, all they're looking for is an opportunity to transform one product format, bullion, into something else, which advantages them in terms of a commission generated. So the vast majority of people who I've seen privatize their IRAs, they're the patsies in this equation. And I think the more effective approach is if you can convert from a traditional to a Roth, you've given yourself every possible advantage moving forward, looking at what is the most likely outcome for our federal government, nearly bankrupt, needing to raise taxes. You can go ahead and take care of your taxes today and guarantee that you pay zero as and when they raise the heat tomorrow.
Well, Dave, again, the questions didn't disappoint. We have listeners that really do pay attention and think for themselves. And I just want to say thank you right now for the response that we got.
I know it's difficult to think of curiosity as an asset class, but if you can feed your curiosity and invest in a greater sense of curiosity in 2016, I think you're going to find yourself more engaged with the relationships around you, the current events which are occurring around you, with the changes in asset classes, actual asset classes. And I would just encourage you, in the same vein that you've sent these questions to us, continue to ask questions and live comfortably with the tension of not being able to answer them immediately, but pursue the answers relentlessly as you grow in your understanding of the world that you're living in and the ways in which it is changing, because there are opportunities which in the next few years, I think will present themselves as once in a generation, perhaps even once in a 1,000-year type opportunities. And I think you will be the kind of person that is there to take advantage of them to the extent that you've trained your mind and heart to not only identify them, but have the courage to do something about them. To me, the route to that end is investing in that strange little asset class that I would call curiosity.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.